From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Well, we're back, folks, and we're going to open up this week's coverage of things going on around the world with a discussion with Mark Sloboda, who's an analyst that lives in Moscow, an American-born, retired U.S. Navy, and we're taking a look at what's going on around Russia because there's an awful lot of stuff in motion, and maybe some of it's kind of dangerous. Mark, bring us up to speed, and welcome back.
Yeah, Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR, and not really retired military. Retired is 20 years. I was 6 years and out. Nuclear termed out.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I, you know, my honorable discharge and all that. But I actually turned down a it was close to a $200,000 reenlistment bonus for 2 years.
Whoa, baby.
Yeah. And I said, and that was it. Like 24, 25, and I said, no thanks, I'm out.
Wow.
So we're talking Ukraine. We're talking developments that we're leading up to, and what we have just had is very tense, high stake security negotiations between Russia and the U.S. and Russia and NATO, where Russia demanded written, legally binding security guarantees from the U.S. and NATO in the month before the holidays, and they presented draft documents basically of their demands and to the US and NATO, and said this is what we require for security guarantees, and if not, things are going to a bad place.
Maybe give us a little context. Like they didn't just drop out of the sky and say, hey, let's make some demands on the West. What's behind this?
Just finish. Those negotiations failed, and now we're moving into where does Russia respond? How does Russia respond? And I don't think the Kremlin actually knows 100%. They have a range of options, and the language that they have used is the American diplomatic equivalent of saying all options are on the table. And now they're reviewing the options. And where this was all initiated is somewhere in the last year, Russia, the Russian government has taken a look at what has been happening around them in recent years in Belarus, this latest attempted coup slash likely some degree of foreign involvement. I don't want to outright say color revolution, but there's almost certainly some Western involvement in what was also in but color revolutions, of course, always have an internal element, right? There is always a discontent, disapproving political minority entity, something that is exploited, you know, to drive divisions and overthrow a government for U.S. foreign policy purposes.
Right.
That is the MO. This was some smaller degree of color revolution element with some own internal political problems. But the Russian government and the Chinese government, it must be said, clearly believe that the West was playing a degree of political meddling in all of this, particularly with the coincidental timing that was unacceptable. But particularly at Ukraine, and when the Ukrainian government was overthrown with open U.S. and European backing in 2014, when it was a democratically elected government, however flawed, a government that the U.S. and the EU had called, you know, the cleanestly elected government in independent Ukrainian history, and were willing to work with Yanukovych up until he dared say no to the EU's neoliberal shock therapy diktat of their association agreement. And when that happened, well, that's it. Yanukovych was immediately targeted, and contingency plans went into motion to use forces, political forces from West Ukraine that had lost the last election, unholy amalgamation of far right West Ukrainian ultranationalists / Banderite fascists, coupled with pro-Western liberals. And that is what brought the government down there. The initial Russian response was, all right, first of all, we can consolidate Crimea because 90% of the people there don't want anything to 90% plus of the people there don't want anything to do what's happening in Crimea or in the rest of Ukraine. Like the people in the East Ukraine, the people of Crimea voted overwhelmingly for the guy who was just overthrown, and not because they loved him so much, because he was the lesser of two evils to keep out the people who then seized power in the Maidan. They didn't want to have anything to do with that. The West Ukrainian ultranationalism, the realignment away from Russia, the taking away of their autonomy in the Crimea, which had been a legacy of the Soviet Constitution that was kept on in Ukraine. They didn't want it. And on top of that, Russia, of course, did not want to see their primary naval bases. They had naval bases by lease or by treaty lease, longstanding, in Ukraine, their main naval bases, which would, of course, be seized, would be retracted by a new regime in Kiev and turned over to NATO. They could not strategically see that happen. They'd get their access to the Black Sea, to the Med, effectively cut off, lose their main naval base. They couldn't. That two combination of factors led them, to leave their bases. There was already 25,000 troops there by treaty. They simply assisted the people of Crimea, and my wife, among them, it must be said, full disclosure, conflict of interest maybe, but also, inside perspective. And you don't have to take my word for it. You don't have to take the Russian government's word for it. And I know you're not listening to the people of Crimea, but when Pew and Gallup and GFK all poll, support for the referendum, support for what happened there in 90, the results are actually showing higher results than in support of rejoining Russia, leaving right. Ukraine and rejoining Russia. There's a reason for that,
right? And not for nothing, by the way. Not only would Russia lose this prime naval base on the Black Sea, they would lose it in the same way that you lose something in battle. It would suddenly be a NATO base on their on their border.
Yes, yeah. On top of that, you had a similar situation in Donbass, but it was viewed as not advantageous to bring the Donbass into Russia, even if they wanted to, because ultimately a Donbass that is part of Ukraine would ultimately allow Russia to leverage the rest of Ukraine to keep it out of NATO, hopefully. And that was the whole point of the Minsk Accords. We help the people there who genuinely don't support what happened in Kiev, just like the West is helping the people that seized power in Kiev, right? It is a proxy war. There is a civil conflict in Ukraine, and there is also a proxy conflict, right? That is clear. The West and NATO backing the people that seized power in Kiev, and Russia backing the people of East Ukraine and Donbass. And that has been ongoing for years. Russia forced Kiev early on, with its support of and this was indirect support for the most part, right? The reason why the people of Donbass were able to win early victories over the Ukrainian military, the people that had seized power in Kiev, it's because the Ukrainian military didn't exist, right? The vast majority of it either defected or refused to fight. I mean, by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's own accounts, 75% of the Ukrainian Navy, the personnel, either defected to Crimea or Donbass, meaning, effectively Russia, particularly in the Crimean case, or just quit. right? And that was the same. They refused to fight in Donbass. And that is why most of the initial attacks on Donbass were done by these nascent battalions, which had been part of the militias on the Maidan headed by the neo-Nazi Andrei Perubi. Right Sector, Azov, Tornado, you know, these other groups. And they are ultra-nationalists, I think is a nice way of putting it. They're Banderite fascists.
Yeah, right? Nazis.
Neo-Nazis, at the very least, or you know, even harkening back to some of the early thing. Now, most of their hatred and violence is directed at ethnic Russians, leftists.
And Jews.
And Slovak East Ukrainians, not Jews. No, not Jews.
Really?
That's a secondary tier thing for them now, because they don't regard that as a threat to their national identity, which is why they have tolerated Zelensky as you know, the of Jewish descent president, right? And this is always what's used to dismiss. Oh, how can Ukraine be neo-Nazi? You know, how, and it's never like they're not Nazis, right? They have got people who believe in their own homegrown anti-Russian version of Ukrainian fascism that was collaborating with the Nazis in World War II, because it dovetails into this hatred of ethnic Russia. And that's because of the unique history of Western Ukraine. They weren't actually part of Ukraine up until right before World War II. They were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth before that. Right. They hated the Russian Empire. They hated the Soviet Union. They hate Russian Federation today. And it's two competing conceptions of Ukrainian national identity, because the people of East Ukraine feel the opposite. Right. Their national identity is, oh, you know, we can't even tell what's a Russian and what's a Ukrainian over here. We're so intermixed. You know, we speak Russian mostly at home, like most people in Ukraine did up until 2014. And we don't regard them as enemies. We regard them as our friends with some kind of border in between, brothers, sisters, family, with some kind of new border that sprung up there. Crazy, like, you know, in the middle of the night in 1992. You know, that's the way they view it. And those are two competing conceptions of Ukrainian national identity. And what the Maidan did is stopped the balance between them that kept Ukraine balanced domestically between West and East, and kept it balanced in geopolitical terms as an effectively neutral country between West and East. And instead, this West Ukraine generally – West Ukrainian sense of a Ukrainian national identity was forced on the East, you know, by having their political parties banned, in the case of the communists and the left parties, lustrated, and, you know, forced to reform. Now their leaders are imprisoned and their media shut down. Right. And because that flipping of Ukraine and that dominance of the West Ukrainian national identity cannot be allowed to be revisited. Now, Russia thought that all of this would collapse after a few years. They thought, we support, you know, the people in East Ukraine, you know, like the NATO is supporting the people that seized power in Kiev. You know, we keep them going. We keep them separate. We make them agree to these Minsk Accords, you know, which with, you know, the Ukrainian battalions defeated in the early days of the war, of the conflict there, you know, by the Donbass militias, which were largely a lot of ex-police, military and security services, particularly from the east of the country, as well as the miners and the normal civilian people. You know, they won that early conflict, and Kiev had to agree to these Minsk Accords. And eventually, you know, this was guaranteed by France and Germany, and the U.S. signed on to it when it came to the U.N. Security Council. And technically, everyone still agrees that's the way forward, but it has not been implemented in 7 years now.
Right.
And the reason for that is because you know, the government in Kiev, whether that was Poroshenko or now Zelensky, has simply refused to sit down with the leaderships, you know, the leaders in East Ukraine, the authorities there that were elected, you know, quote, elected, like the people in Kiev are elected. It's not what you would call a genuine, you know, full democratic election, but it is generally, you know, somewhat equivalent to popular sentiment. In both cases. Mm-hmm. And Russia's position has always been, we do not recognize the Donbass, DNR and LNR, the Donetsk National Republic and the Lugansk National Republic as independent countries. And we do not fully recognize, you know, the regime in Kiev as legitimately representing Ukraine until there is a political reconciliation to reconcile what happened with the overthrowing of the government in 2014. There are only de facto authorities.
Right.
And that is the way they have dealt with it.
Yeah, it's an, which is realistic. I mean, you're talking, first of all, you're talking about there was a coup d'etat. They drove the elected president out of the country in fear of his life.
Yes.
There was a government appointed on the telephone, basically, between Victoria Nuland from the State Department and Geoffrey Pyatt, who was the U.S. ambassador to Kiev at the time.
Yes.
I mean, in other words, they said, well, it should be so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so, and lo and behold, within 2 or 3 days, that's who the government is.
Yes.
And then from that springs an election, quote-unquote, conducted by the coup government that results in Poroshenko being elected that does not include a fair representation from the eastern half of the population.
Yes.
And then from that, another successive government is quote-unquote elected. Also, the parties of the people in the east are illegal. Their leaders are in prison. And so to claim some sort of legitimacy for this government over the people in the east is absurd, even by like the standards of the UN Charter.
Yeah, it's ridiculous to call, you know, what is in Ukraine democratic. It has geopolitical, I wouldn't even call it pro-Western, because a lot of the people there are ultra-nationalists and so on, at least, you know, a significant portion of them. I don't say that it's a neo-Nazi government. I say they had a neo-Nazi vanguard that is now integrated throughout the political parties, right, throughout the security services, the police, the military, and so on. And they are a minority who is extremely passionate and extremely active and organized and motivated, and it shows what a small group of people can do to take over the politics of a much larger population and country. Russia thought all of this would collapse through the course of the Minsk Accords. There would be a reconciliation, this overwhelming dominance by force and repression of the West Ukrainian national identity and politics would be balanced out. Ukraine would be restored to internal balance and outward neutrality. And that is the way things would go. And slowly, you know, the dominant economic relations with Russia would assure that Russia still had influence. And while Ukraine could not be brought into the Collective Security Treaty Organization or the Eurasian Union, it would also not be a part of NATO and the EU. And that was acceptable to Russia,
right,
but it was not acceptable any longer to the U.S. and the EU. You have to remember that all of this happened before, in 2005, with the Orange Revolution, right? Yushchenko took power, and there was an attempt to do that, but it was stopped because of heavy East Ukrainian perspective, you know, political parties, then the Party of Regions and the Communists, in two parties that no longer exist, one banned, one lustrated, in representing East Ukraine. And the next time an election came around, he was voted out with like 8% approval left in the country.
Right.
Russia thought that was what would happen again. They thought that, you know, the economic pressure, not actually generated by Russia, but simply by suicidally refusing to do business with their biggest economic partner,
right,
of the new government, and the unwillingness of the West to adequately fund them, and the political divide between the ultra-nationalists and the liberals that were papered over with the Maidan, that it would all eventually collapse and fall apart. But it hasn't. That was the position for 6 or 7 years. And there were people in Russia, including advisors of Putin at the time, who said, you know, you need to take care of this now. in 2014, 2015, because this is not going to fall apart. And in a few years, you're going to have these ultra-nationalists, these neo-Nazis and Azov and right sector, educating Ukrainian kids in school to hate and kill Russians. And you will have NATO erecting military bases in Ukraine and training Ukrainian forces to act, you know, as a platform against Russia. And, you know, they'll have rebuilt their entire military within 5 years. And here we are, and it's 7 years later, and the Russian advisors who said that were correct, and I was actually one of them who has have been saying that since the time.
Yeah, you have.
And NATO, you know, has no agreement on bringing Ukraine into NATO, even though it was promised in 2008. Back when only 20% of Ukrainians wanted to join NATO, that it was said by NATO in official documents in Bucharest in 2008 that Ukraine will join NATO. Well, that's kind of like, that's a hook or crook deal when only 20% of the people said they wanted to. Yeah. But things have been maneuvered, you know, very adroitly, it must be said, since then. And, you know, all of this has come out that while Ukraine has not been offered a formal path to membership, what Russia sees is the de facto NATOization of Ukraine happening on the ground. Right. They see that there are now some 10,000 NATO trainers and advisors, quote unquote, shade of Vietnam in Ukraine.
Right.
They see that the UK has announced that they are building naval bases, military bases in Ukraine. They see advanced U.S. weapons, Javelin and others starting to pour into the country. And they say, all right, this is and they see that the U.S. is continuing to keep the government in there alive, you know, barely, but on a drip feed through the IMF and, you know, averting, economic and political collapse. So eventually they have reached this conclusion that they cannot allow this to continue anymore. The frozen conflict has continued in the East daily. People are dying in the Donbass from government shelling, despite the supposed ceasefire and the frozen conflict there. And they said this cannot continue. And they said this is our red lines, right? We need to revisit a lot of what has happened with NATO expansion since 1997, since promises were made to a naive and trusting Mikhail Gorbachev, who didn't get it written down, and not that that would have made any difference anyway, considering the way the U.S. has pulled out of the ABM Treaty, the Open Skies Treaty, the Medium Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Conventional Armed Forces in Europe Treaty, again and again and again.
And right? their check even bounced for the lunch that they bought at the last summit.
So, but Russia has said red lines, and they obviously can't roll back NATO membership. And that's not what they're demanding, but they're saying that that first of all, Ukraine and Georgia cannot be brought into NATO because that would be an unacceptable security risk for us. And you have meddled in these two countries so much in the past 20 years that we don't think that it adequately represents. You have elevated certain anti-Russian political forces in those societies. We don't think it's reflective of those societies overall. And these two countries, you and us both need them as a buffer zone between us, because otherwise that's too much tension.
It's a flash.
Effectively saying we want these countries Finlandized,
right?
And that is not necessarily a bad thing.
No,
if it keeps the two most powerful militaries in the world separated from each other. Finland was a quiet, peaceful place all during the Cold War. You know,
that's right.
Because of that process, when it comes to the U.S. the rest of NATO should not be able, as was promised at the time, to put military forces in the permanently stationed in the new Eastern European countries of NATO, and that includes, of course, the anti-ballistic missile, also ballistic missile capable cruise missile firing capable Aegis Ashore systems in Poland and Romania, the new thousands of troops in, you know, in the Baltics, right on Russia's borders, and so on and so on. You know, this is the, and you have to agree to a new limited version of the INF treaty, where you promise not to put U.S. Intermediate range missiles in Europe, and we will not put them in range. We will keep them beyond the Urals. We know that you're not going to agree to a new INF treaty because we know that, you know, that's would be viewed by you as pulling your hand behind your back in your conflict, coming conflict with China and the South China Sea. That's why you wanted out of it in the first place. We know that, but we'll work this as a new common security architecture. And Russian presidents, you know, whether Putin, Medvedev, now Putin again, have been saying this for you know, the last 20 years, let us agree to a new common security architecture that includes Russia as part of Europe and guarantees our security and takes our interests into account as well, rather than leaving us outside, right, and precipitating this military buildup between the two of us. And, you know, you don't have to – you can go back to the headlines of the New York Times and the Washington Post talking about why – the expansion of NATO eastwards was viewed as a bonanza for the U.S. arms manufacturers from the military-industrial complex. And that peace with Russia would be bad for business.
Catastrophic. Right? That's right. You know, right? You look at Canadian bacon hacker. What's his name? The guy. Yeah, right.
You can forget the geopolitical concerns, hegemony to the side. That is also important, but there is also a huge economic motivation.
Huge.
But the result of it has been, you know, pushing Russia and China together for the last 20 years, where they're now back to back and becoming very fast, you know, allies militarily, economically, politically.
Shotgun wedding, right.
So, you know, the U.S. has refused Russia's security guarantees, which if you read through them, you know, from a basis, they are actually pretty fair.
They're reasonable. Agreed.
They are reasonable in something that would keep the peace.
Right.
You know, the U.S. is on this, Ukraine is a sovereign country and they have a right to make their own security decisions and if they want to join NATO. Okay, well, they were a sovereign country until you helped overthrow the government and put in these pro-NATO people in 2014. And we can't help but notice that Syria does not have the right to, form their – you're always demanding that Iran – you know, we're not leaving Syria, our military occupation of Syria, East Syria, until Iran is gone. Right. So they don't have the choice to make Iran as allies or Hezbollah or
Cuba, Venezuela. Yeah, right. Right.
Right. Cuba doesn't have the right to make military allies as they want. Right. Right? So let's knock off that hypocritical principle nonsense.
Right.
People have that right only as long as they want to align geopolitically with you.
Right.
That's the way, you know, the Russian realist perspective of looking at this is you're hypocrites. And this government was brought into power with your very open support and no small degree of orchestration. And, you know, you've manipulated events, you know, all the way up to this point. So, you know, let's keep the peace. You know, let's not go down this road. Now, the question is, Russia, as they probably knew, they made these demands public, which the U.S. Right. was very, very unhappy about.
Right.
And because they wanted full transparency on this, considering what happened back with Gorbachev and these deals under the table that were never adhered to and everything. And, you know, all the time Russia has been saying, if we don't, we will have to take matters into our own hands to ensure our own security by military technical measures. What does that mean?
Yeah.
That's really vague. That could mean anything from we're going to put our new hypersonic missiles in Kaliningrad to we're going to reopen military bases in Cuba and maybe put a few in Venezuela as well. Yep. So you feel the same sense of Cuban Missile Crisis threat in your hemisphere that we now feel in ours. And then let's hear you say, you know, the U.S. has already responded to that suggestion to the press saying they would take decisive action because Russians aren't allowed in their hemisphere. You see the way, you know, this.
Yes, I understand it. We've got like 10 seconds. So
So the third option is a military intervention in Ukraine. And there's a lot of signs that the Russian military has made some steps to allow that option to be taken in short order if the Kremlin takes that decision. And that could be what we're going into in the next few weeks here.
And that's not going to turn out well. All right, so we'll pick this up next week, because unfortunately, this ain't going away. And appreciate you, man. Thank you very much, Mark. It was a pleasure speaking with you again.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.